This is the Guy Gordon Show on News Talk 760 WJR.
We know the city of Detroit still has a long way to go, but my goodness, this $1.5 billion District Detroit development proposal could go a long way to moving the ball down the field in terms of revitalizing housing, education. But there is a trade-off to be had. The developers are asking for city tax abatements, and right now that's being debated at city council. We thought we might get a decision today. I don't think that's going to happen. But in the final hours, in the 11th hour of this debate, Council President Mary Sheffield wants the Illich family to agree to a 2% ticket surcharge on any event in the Arena District. So what do you think about that? I mean, the idea is that she's extracting something from the Illiches in return for the city tax abatement, but that's not coming from the Illiches. I think it's coming from us when we buy tickets, right? It's a surcharge. Let's get more on the story from WJR senior news analyst Lloyd Jackson as we invite you to weigh in as well at 1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WJR. Where are we in this debate, and will there be a resolution today, Lloyd?
Well, no, it won't. That can was kicked a little further down the street.
That is one beat-up can that they've got there.
It's almost disintegrated, Guy, I'm telling you. City Council was expected to vote on the $167 million community benefits agreement, which is related to that $1.5 billion District Detroit project, but they moved it to next Tuesday for a vote. So another week and we'll get a vote. Now, other than public comment, there was really no discussion between council about the project. So next Tuesday, all requests related to the District Detroit development will be on the agenda, such as establishment of neighborhood enterprise zones or commercial rehabilitation zones within the District Detroit project. Now, one item that had been moved out of committee but not placed on the full agenda today was a transformational brownfield redevelopment plan. Now, Council President Pro Tem James Tate, he apologized for that. He said he dropped the ball and inadvertently left it off the agenda last week, where it would have been referred to the full City Council today. So that will be on the agenda next week. Developers of the project, Olympia Development, and the related companies are asking for $800 million in local and state tax incentives. The District Detroit project calls for the construction of rehab of about 10 buildings in and around downtown Detroit, including 695 new apartments, of which 20% would be low income. It also includes 1.2 million square feet of commercial office space and 467 new hotel rooms. The community benefits package included $11 million in new direct financial contributions to the community, as well as $100 million in specialty target spending, such as doing business with Black and Hispanic-owned contractors. It also included a parking and transit benefit and a creation of some green space as well. That was all included in the community benefits package. Now, City Council wanted that community benefits agreement in place before they considered any tax incentives for the District Detroit project. So the community benefits package was not voted on today, kicked down the street one more time till next week. And once that's done, I believe that's when those incentive requests will be taken up. A lot of public comment today, Guy, you know, a mixed bag of, yeah, you know, we think this was a great thing. This is going to bring jobs. It's going to be great for the city. It's going to help expand into the neighborhoods. And others say, listen, we can't keep giving billionaires money. If they want to do this project, let them do it themselves. So still a lot of that. You're always going to get that in public comment. But as far as a decision today, not going to happen today.
Some of this is a self-inflicted wound on the part of the Olympia development folks, because they promised so much so many years ago, and then the perception is that they didn't deliver. But I got to say, I want to get back to Council President Sheffield's.
Yeah, the 2%.
Yeah, 2% ticket surcharge. Look, she calls it a surcharge. That implies it's a transaction where the people who are paying it get something in return. In that case, it's us. So are we going to get better lighting, easier parking? Is there intended use for this revenue? And if that isn't there, then call it a tax, for goodness sake, not a surcharge, because that's what it is.
I thought, and maybe I'm wrong, Guy, I thought it was a reduction on the surcharges that are on tickets to events. Because, you know, they charge a surcharge.
Right. No, she wants the Illich family to agree to a 2% ticket surcharge. They're going to put that as an added thing onto the onto every ticket, was my understanding. That's what a surcharge is.
And so, and then that, but, you know, and so that means anybody who comes into the city, who buys a ticket for
exactly,
will have to pay that extra 2%. And people were saying that you had to go through the legislature about that, but she says, no, this is almost kind of like a gentleman's, like a handshake agreement between them two, that like it wouldn't have to go through the legislature.
Look, I think it's bad business when you negotiate a community benefits deal and then the 11th hour you try to stick something else in there.
Yeah,
secondly, don't call it a be honest in it. If you want to get a little more revenue out of this deal, then say so. But don't tell me, as a member of the ticket buying public, that I have to pay it and that somehow you're getting something from the billionaires. You're not. You're getting it from me.
And this is outside of the community benefits plan. Was, you know, they had meetings on it. You had this group who came together and talked about what they wanted. They voted on it. They approved that. And then it moved to city council. And this is outside of that. So, yeah, it's kind of disingenuous, you know, at the last minute.
And if you want some other dedicated revenue, I would say to Mary Sheffield, fine. Tell me what I'm paying for as someone who's driving down to Detroit to take advantage of the many great new amenities that we have down here. Tell me what I'm getting in return. Parking management? Is it great? Better traffic? What am I getting there? Or is it just a money grab on something that, you know, geez, Lloyd, you and I remember when we went for years without even having a housing construction permit issued in this city. When it wasn't white flight anymore, it was just green flight. Anybody with money was leaving. And the fact is that whether she likes it or not, she can call it whatever it is. The law is going to call it a tax, and you do have to go to the legislature to get permission for a new tax levy of an entertainment venue.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Maybe I'm making too big a deal of it. I just think that, A, you've got somebody, and if you want to be, they're billionaires, and so I have automatic resentment, fine, whatever. But you've got investors coming in willing to do something that we desperately need. And to then try to say that you're going to nail us both in the city and suburbs for patronizing that, just seems to me to be really just bad for business. And it is a return to the kind of policies that got us in the mess in the first place.
And I think the people, Guy, who are against this project, if council is trying to go back to the developers and ask for more money, thinking that that's going to get them to change their mind on the fact that, you know, they don't want the project, I don't think that's going to work.
Yeah. Well, let's ask our friends about it. Thanks so much, Lloyd. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Guy.
Good reporting as always. We ask you, so what do you think about this? Is it a surcharge? Is it a tax? Are you saying, you know what, I'll pay for that tax if it will improve the city? Maybe you don't care. I do. I already think the ticket prices are way overpriced. So curious as to what you think about this, and if this isn't just a way of saying, yeah, we're going to stick it to the suburbs, or we just don't care. We're going to get our money here. 1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WJR. Is this another little indication that maybe the city is not resisting its best impulses and may try to kill the golden goose? So it is Tuesday, and there is no arrest, no indictment of former President Donald Trump, no protest out in front of City Hall there, or the Hall of Justice. So that prediction from the president didn't come to pass. Doesn't mean it's not going to happen. I think they're still wrapping up some witnesses in the grand jury. And if it does, boy, it's going to be one of the dumbest prosecutions I think we've ever seen. President Trump appears to be trying to make the most of it. He emailed voters yesterday and saying, I want you to protest. And so here's a petition that allows you to do that. And they say they've got millions and millions of signatures. Well, we should also point out that when you click on that to sign the petition, and many of you may have already done this, you're asked for a donation with suggested amounts ranging from $2,400 to $3,300, depending on your circumstances. And as yet, though, it appears that this call for a protest, if he did mean a physical protest, isn't going to, at least according to the chatter that's on a lot of the, some of the encrypted and even unencrypted chat lines where people that are more extremist oriented, is not being answered. On Truth Social, his own social media platform. President Trump supporters are driving a different kind of narrative. They're saying that there's no way that they would come to a protest because they think it's a trap, that there will be what they called stage actors there who will do bad things, and that will just get Trump supporters arrested, which is what they claim the narrative was around January 6th. And so we've got a number of different folks. There's a guy from Britain, Paul Joseph Watson. He polled 218,000 followers of the Oz on True Social with this question. Is the potential protest against Trump being arrested a J6-style trap? 85% said yes. So there is some paranoia out there in terms of what they think is going to happen. So, hopefully whatever happens, it is orderly. No members of the NYPD or security are going to be put at risk. The former president's not going to be put at risk if it comes to that. And if he's ordered to appear to answer this indictment, which his attorneys have said that he will voluntarily do. In the meantime, could be that he's making a whole lot of money off of this as a very strategic fundraising effort. And he ain't crazy. He's a pretty sly fellow, and he knows an opportunity when he sees one. So you got that going down. By the way, if you got a thought on Mary Sheffield and her 2% so-called surcharge on your concert tickets, claiming she wants revenue from the Ilitches, doesn't seem to understand maybe the concept of a surcharge, is that that's just passed along to us. We'd love to hear what you have to say about it. 1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WJR. The president, former President Trump, is saying that whatever this is about, it's not about me, folks. It's all about you. They are coming after you. Here's just a bit of the, well, it was about a two-minute call it a rant, call it an address, him talking to his followers that was on Truth Social. Cut one.
Whether it's the Mar-a-Lago raid or the Unselect Committee hoax, the perfect Georgia phone call, it was absolutely perfect, or the Stormy Horseface Daniels extortion plot, they're all sick, and it's fake news. Our enemies are desperate to stop us because they know that we are the only ones who can stop them, and they know it very strongly, and they're looking at the polls where not me, but we are up by so much. They can't even believe it. We won twice, and now we've got to win a third time. They know that we can defeat them. They know that we will defeat them. But they're not coming after me. They're coming after you. I'm just standing in their way, and I always will stand in their way. Thank you very much.
Michonne Maddock among those echoing President Trump, saying an attack on Trump is an attack on all of us. So I'm imploring you right now, if they arrest the greatest president in history, protest. Cross their line in the sand. Display your MAGA hats, T-shirts, get the yard signs out. He always has our backs. Show him we've got his.
You know, guy, President Trump, former President Trump said in that clip, they're not coming after you, me. They're coming after you, and I'm just in the way, which I've seen as a meme a million times on Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
My question is, who's coming for us? And if they were really coming for us, why didn't they get us before or after Trump?
Who's the they?
Right. Who are we supposed to be paranoid about?
You know, it's those Soros-backed people. By the way, something kind of interesting, a little bit off the mark, though, but in one of the depositions against Fox News in the Dominion case, there's now a Fox producer suing Fox News, saying that she was forced to lie in the Dominion lawsuit. And in part of it, she's talking about things that went down within the walls of Fox. And she claims that she personally saw Tucker Carlson's staff holding a mock debate about whether they would prefer to have sex with Ms. Dixon or her Democratic opponent, Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Well, if that isn't kind of a frat boy sit down, it would be dismissed as locker room talk, but kind of disparaging of two women, both of them of good character, and just kind of sad that you would think Tucker would be above that. I don't know. Tom's in Fenton with some thoughts on all of this. Tom, do you think this makes the president more attractive, or do you think that, and is this an attack on all of us?
No, I don't think it makes him more attractive. And to be honest, I'm tired of all this Trump drama. I think DeSantis is the better choice. He's Trump without all the baggage. If you support conservative causes, why would you support someone that's lost the election? It makes it all about him. It just kind of clouds things.
Well, and you could argue that he's lost, what, four, maybe five elections because of his interceding in them. There was the special runoff in Georgia in 2020, the presidential election in 2020, certainly the midterms here in 2018, certainly was a reflection of kind of a backlash against Donald Trump and Trumpism to some extent. So, yeah, I'm kind of wondering when people are going to say, look, and it doesn't just have to. Let me ask you this. You mentioned Ron DeSantis. Why Ron DeSantis and not a Mike Pompeo or a Nikki Haley, who are certainly strong and they were certainly defenders of many of the policies that Donald Trump promoted?
They were, but I think Republican voters have to be smart this time, because the last time that Trump got the nomination, because there were like 16 candidates running, he didn't have a majority to start with. He got maybe 30%. People that want Biden defeated, that want to see an alternative to Biden, need to unite behind one candidate, not go with the perfect candidate. I'm not a big fan of DeSantis, but I am not a fan of Donald Trump. And I'll vote for DeSantis in the Republican primary in Michigan, because I don't want Trump around anymore in the public eye. I mean, it's just too much.
Well, you better hope that we have a primary, Tom. I got to tell you, the chairperson of the Republican Party right now in the state was making noises over in Muskegon a couple of weekends ago that, well, we might have to have a caucus or a convention because the Democrats moved the primary. She promised me on this show that she was going to support a primary, and now she's suggesting otherwise. I hope she's not changing her mind or maybe wasn't upfront with me to begin with. But, I hope we have a primary. I hope guys like you have a chance to make a choice. And I got to tell you, I think your take on that is correct. We certainly are going to have to winnow down the field early in the primary process if an alternative to Trump has any hope of
that's
rising
right. That's
to the
right.
top. You're a smart guy. Thank you, sir. Appreciate the call. So hopefully, as I said, the extremist folks that have in the past shown up for these things, perhaps they'll bypass this one because they feel it will be against their best interest. Quick thing here, 60 seconds for a big Michigan case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And a young man has become victorious. His name is Miguel Luna Perez. He's 27 years old, came out of the Sturgis Public School System. He is deaf. And he claims that he was his civil rights and his right to an education was violated because they never gave him someone who knew American Sign Language. And in fact, he never learned American Sign Language because he was never provided with anybody that could teach it to him. And so now at the age of 27, he's, trying to exist in this world. He reads at a third or fourth grade level. He went to the high court demanding that his lawsuit against the district be allowed to go forward. And unanimously, the justices have granted that. So now he will seek damages from the Sturgis school system. A lot of it had to do with a lot of arcane stuff about whether he followed all the rules. They said he shouldn't have to, that he was owed that. It's a pretty vivid memory. You'll remember not that too many months ago as we were heading into the August primary, two front runners, five candidates, all Republicans, basically deprived of an ability to get on the ballot because of fraud in the signature gathering process required for the nominating petitions. We also have a very robust citizens initiative tradition here in the state of Michigan, where we use the petition process to force issues on the legislature or to change our constitution. So it's pretty alarming when the process appears to be broken and is riddled with fraud. So how do we fix it? How do we make sure the fraudsters are detected and the process, which is so important, safeguarded? Tony Daunt has been involved in a few of those petition campaigns over the years. He's now a Republican appointee to the State Board of Canvassers, which is weighing how we can do this better and fix it, because this is kind of a very important part of our voice. Tony, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, guys. Thanks for having me.
I know that some of these things can get kind of weedy and complicated, but just to get to the root of it, what's at stake here for Michigan voters?
You're very correct. It can be difficult to distill this stuff down into something that doesn't glaze over the eyes of most people. But essentially, you kind of hit on it nicely in your intro there. What Director Brader, Bureau of Elections Director Jonathan Brader, and his team have put before us on the Board of Canvassers is really nice work product. Took the time to look at how we have canvassed petitions and the signatures of those petitions over the last several decades, and they're seeking to essentially modernize a good deal of it, take into account the advent of the qualified voter file that eases some of the work that they do, and with the request or the recommendation that we move to a sampling process for the larger signature gathering efforts for offices like governor and U.S. senator, where they turn in a minimum of 15,000 signatures, move to a sample process so that they are doing a mathematical and statistically sound review of what has been turned in, so that we don't have or at least have an easier way of catching the fraud that was so rampant in the process last year. And I'm sure that there was fraud that simply wasn't detected in some of the other issues that came before us, just because of lack of time and the need to get things approved and ready for the ballot within a compressed window. And so I commend them. I'm thinking through all of the things that have been put before us, but I think ultimately they've got good intentions, and I'm happy to be part of the board that's considering this.
So, the problem is when you modernize some things, what we don't want to do is, as you point out, lower our standards here. I know one of the biggest problems is that it's so time consuming. I think there's also a concern that the process we've been using, the software we've been using, could soon expire, correct? Are they still using Windows Vista to process this stuff? What are they doing?
The presentation we received yesterday essentially laid out that the computer program that's being used is so old and antiquated that the Microsoft doesn't, new systems don't support it. And so, I like to, in my imagination, I envision this room with this giant, closet-sized computer doing this. I'm sure that's not what it is, but, when you think back to this process being established in the early 80s, the sampling and the review that we've used successfully over those 40 years, it is time to modernize. It's time to think through some of the things that the staff does.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think, they lay out a compelling argument from an efficiency standpoint and a use of their time standpoint of, eliminating, for instance, the face review phase, which is essentially staff from the Bureau of Elections looking at each, petition sheet and mm-hmm. looking to see, is there something on it that makes the entire sheet defective? For instance, one of the required check boxes being left blank, or a circulator not filling out their portion appropriately or completely.
Okay.
And, there's compelling arguments, I think, on both sides of whether or not this is something that should be done. And does it help with weeding out bad actors? Ultimately, the discussion we had yesterday and that I'm sympathetic towards and leaning towards is, bad actors will ultimately be found out in the sampling process, because if you turn in a whole boatload of garbage, of fraud, of stuff that's just bad, whether you meant to or not, by virtue of being in that universe and able to be selected for the sample, the statistical analysis tells you that if you turn in 30% of your stuff of 500,000, then about 30% of it should be captured in the sample and reviewed by the staff. And
right.
It can be done in just a more efficient fashion.
Yeah, that you don't need that so-called face review. I got to ask you, though, it was so rampant this past time around. It's got to beg the question, are the penalties against the fraud perhaps too low that they're no longer acting as a deterrent?
I think that's a valid question. I think, I don't know of any recent updates to the referrals that were made to the Attorney General's office for investigation of the people who committed that fraud. And, as with anything in life, the punishment needs to be severe enough that it deters most, not all people, but most people from engaging in that. And I think there was such a high demand for signatures last year that, and there were, unfortunately, you know, too many bad actors, both in the circulator world and then the petition world of people, you know, firms not checking the work of the people that was brought before them. Word got out among circulators that, hey, nobody's checking this stuff. Just turn in what you can, collect the money, and move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's certainly something that should be addressed, and would love to see prosecution of the people engaged in this, because it undermines our faith in the system and in the validity of everything that comes before us. And that's the worst thing we can do is undermine yet another institution or process in our elections.
But you and I have also been witness to a blizzard of lawsuits, too. Anytime you try to tinker with the rules, how concerned are you that whatever solutions we come up with, there's going to be all kinds of legal challenges and that it may not pass legal muster?
That's always a concern for myself, and I think each of my fellow members on this board. It's inherently a partisan process, and there are some strong disagreements, not just on the topics or the subjects that come before us, but the interpretation of the laws and the rules and regulations that apply to us.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly we make these changes and there is a candidate or an issue that ends up being rejected as a result of these changes, or even not even the result. You know, maybe they would have been rejected under the old system. Everybody's always looking for a way to get their issue on the ballot. And so it's a concern, but it's not one that's driving my decision-making on this, because I think they're sound recommendations. And, it's one of those things where whatever we do on this board, usually somebody's going to sue us. And so it's just part of the job.
So sad. I got to ask you, though, we may see one for right to work. I think we could be just minutes away from the repeal to be actually concluded in the legislature. We've heard that there's going to be some kind of a petition drive to repeal the repeal. But because of an appropriation in the bill, it could make the bar maybe a little bit higher. Just take off your canvas hat for a moment. And as a guy that has run these things, how much more difficult will it be for citizens to have their voice heard on right to work if they want to see it reinstituted?
Yeah, I think number one, the hypocrisy, to use a kind word, I think, in the governor's willingness to sign this legislation with that appropriation in there is pretty galling. It was part of a transparency pledge she made. She railed against it while she was in the legislature. So that's disappointing to see her tiptoeing around that and finding ways to excuse her signature. More to the point, though, of how hard is it to have your voice heard, it's definitely harder to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot than it is to have a referendum, just by the sheer number of signatures.
Right.
You're talking, 100-some thousand additional signatures. That's the process we're faced with, and it probably will be more difficult for anybody to do this stuff because of the enhanced scrutiny, appropriate scrutiny, on the work that's being provided by the circulators, and just the inherent inability or trouble finding people to do this work and to do it legitimately and within the bounds of the law.
Well, maybe we ought to just get rid of the... our good friend Mike Bouchard just texted me here. I hope he doesn't mind me calling him out. But he said, you know what? Let's just ban these paid collectors of signatures and make it so it's truly a citizen's initiative. And maybe that's something we can work our way through. Tony Daunt, always a pleasure to talk with you. We will await a decision from the election director and your august body.
Well, you bet. I look forward to the decision, and thanks for having me on.
All right. When we come back, it is a new study that asks the question, does getting married really lead to better health and happiness? I think this is fascinating. I hope you do, too. We'll tackle that next on The Guy Gordon Show. One of the things that scientists have now identified as being one of the key steps to happiness is marriage, especially for women. Now, I want to put a disclaimer on this. We're not saying if you're single that you're unhappy. We're not making those conclusions. But the study says what it says. If you are looking for greater health, if you are looking for greater mental well-being, you and happiness, which is such a hard thing to define, you may want to consider a partner. WJR Senior News Analyst Marie Osborne here with that study for us.
So many interesting findings here, Guy. This new study was published in the journal Global Epidemiology. It examined nearly 12,000 American nurses, all women. At the start of the study, they were not married. Researchers studied the ones who got married and compared to them to the ones who remained single. They looked at a psychological perspective, well-being, health, longevity, over 25 years. The women who got married, including those who subsequently divorced, had a 35% lower risk for any reason over the follow-up period than those who did not marry at all. Compared to those who didn't marry, the married women also had lower risk for cardiovascular disease, less depression, loneliness. They were happier, more optimistic, and had a greater sense of purpose and hope. Clinical psychologist Dr. Donna Rockwell, well, she says she's not surprised by these findings.
Being married and having a companion really speaks to and helps our capacity to stay well, to be healthy, to have a positive outlook, and to not feel like we're alone in the world.
She says having another person in your life gives you a deep sense of self-confidence because you feel like you have someone in the foxhole with you. Now, what about divorce? The study found divorce was associated with consistently worse subsequent health and well-being, including greater loneliness and depression. But marriage... well, now that we look at the numbers, marriage is kind of going out of style in the last 30 years. Gallup found that our thoughts about living together outside of marriage have relaxed a lot. Dr. Rockwell says in time, the idea may become appealing to young people again, but it can't be forced.
We're going to have to see how this works out with scientific studies in the future, because I don't know that we can create an environment where we're saying, come on, Gen Zers, get married because you'll have greater longevity. Because that's not the way they're thinking.
So the annual marriage rate has reached an all-time low of 28 marriages per 1,000 unmarried people. Guy, that's down from 76.5 in 1965. That is a big drop. And one last statistic that they found, that the U.S. leads the world in the percentage of its kids growing up in single-parent homes, 23% in 2019, and that compared to just 12% in Germany.
You know what's interesting? If you look, there's got to be something to this just because it's happened naturally for millennia, right? If you look at societies going back through history, there has always been this tradition of marriage. It's not that there are some that don't have it, but most do, which tells you that most societies have concluded it's the right thing. It's a good thing.
Absolutely. And they have, and this isn't the only study like this. There are many other studies that have shown that married people live longer, married men live longer. Now, this study did not deal with men. It just was, again, with the women and the ones who were married and stayed married. Even the ones that divorced still had better, even though they didn't have quite the health outcomes as the ones who stayed married, they still were better off than the ones who just stayed single. So this is something they've known for quite a while.
So how do we know that it isn't just that happy people get married and so then they appear happier? How do we account for the fact? I'm not sure what could be the cart or the horse here.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I asked Dr. Rockwell about that as well. And she's and even in this study, they said that needs to be further examined as well. I mean, also, you could wonder, well, is it that just healthier people have a tendency to get married mm-hmm. as opposed to those like I have better health habits and therefore I have a different outlook on life and therefore I'm going to get married. So all those things, you know, it would take a much deeper kind of study to look at mm-hmm. that. So they don't have the answer to that. They don't have the answer to the question that you asked.
Well, I know they did try to account for it because I think that's why they zeroed in on the nurses that were, you know, past the age of 30 who then got married. Then they had a control subject to say, you know, it may not just be that when you're young and happy, make it. The other thing, I guess, does it have to be a formal marriage compact or I mean, look now. I mean, how many friends do we have that, especially older people, that after they lose a spouse, they cohabitate and they do just fine and have very healthy relationships and seem to be doing well and thriving?
And Dr. Rockwell had said, you know, those people, as long as you have that other person in your life, that is what's important, and that's what has a good health outcome. We know people actually who, you know, they were of age in the 70s, you know, hippy dippy, and they never got married,
right,
and they're still together today.
Yes.
So it's still, those people qualify as long-term relationships. Yes.
And as you well know, I think John and Gail will both say this study is bunk, that the reason you and I are happy is because we married them. Right?
You better believe it. That's right. And talk about long term.
Choices do matter, though. That is, yes, that is very true. And it may not be for everybody, and we're not saying that. But
yeah,
it is something to consider. Marie, thank you.
Thanks, Guy.
No, and we can get some calls on this a little bit later on. 1-800-859-0957. Do you agree with the study? Do you think you're happier and healthier because of your marital status? Now, we know there are some things as unhealthy, a few things as unhealthy as a bad marriage in terms of stress, in terms of certainly mental anguish. But I'm just curious if you want to weigh in on it.
The anecdote I've been hearing my whole life is that men live longer when they're married because they have someone, I don't want to say the N-word, nag, but you have somebody constantly on you to stay up on your checkups or go to the doctor if you're not feeling
sick. Take your meds. Yeah, I think you're right.
Because we like to just power through. You know, okay, my leg's gone, but I'll walk it off. It'll be better.
I had, in the year 2000, I had double pneumonia, and I thought I just had the flu. And I wouldn't go to the doctor, wouldn't go. I think my wife saved my life. So, yeah, you're right about that. That could have been, and yeah. Now we just have to convince Nick. That's all.
Wow, called out.
Yeah. Oh, when we come back, fixing the incentives for corporate America. We know there's a lot of the Democratic agenda that has been whipping through the legislature, and there are areas actually of common concern with Republicans. And one of them is what I really want to focus on for a moment here. And that is this: is there no limit to the amount of corporate incentives that we will give businesses looking to move here? Yes, we want to be competitive. Yes, we want those EV jobs here because we got to replace the battery plants and the transmission plants that are going to be going away with this transition. But is there a way we can do it better? Does there need to be a formula? What protections do we need to build in here? This is something that Senator Mallory McMorrow, a Democrat from Royal Oak, has been pondering and is kind of constructing a piece of thinking on that. And we wanted to connect with her before this actually becomes legislation. Senator, good afternoon.
Thanks, Guy. Good to be here.
So, yeah, we want to outcompete other states. But when you look at this, I mean, $630 million in incentives for Marshall alone. I mean, I've seen things that it could be anywhere from $400,000 to $600,000 per job. Do we need some kind of a formula, or is it always going to be a blank check approach to this competition, and how much does that concern you?
Well, I'm glad that you framed it as doing it better. And as we think about legislation, I continually go back to, I think, around 2017 when Michigan was competing for Amazon HQ2, a headquarters that every other state in the country was competing with. And between the city of Detroit and the state of Michigan, we were prepared to offer them $4 billion mm-hmm. in incentives, and they came back and said, we didn't even crack the top 20 because you don't have the talent and you don't have public transit in that area. So as we're looking at the tools that we have on the table, we know that every other state is doing this. They are putting incentives on the table. But it's the how can we do it better question. How can we make sure every time we go after these projects that we're also investing in ourselves so that at the end of the day, Michiganders are better off because we did this?
Well, and taking that Amazon analogy, I mean, look how that's gone sideways for the state of Virginia, who came in, spent millions on infrastructure improvements for Amazon, and now the project's on pause.
That's exactly right. And what that shows to me is because they baked in as part of the deal it's not just infrastructure for a manufacturing site. It was infrastructure for Northern Virginia that included improvement of roads and expanding transit. So even though that project is paused right now, there are already some benefits to the residents. So we have to be prepared that, you know, the industry is going to change. The economy is going to change. Let's make sure we're coupling these things together so that even if, let's say, something goes sideways with the business, we are still making improvements for all of our residents.
Right, but we've got to make sure that those that maybe went above and beyond to suit this newcomer that we think is coming, how do you extract those benefits, I mean, the cost of those benefits back if this corporation reneges?
Well, this is the importance of clawbacks, and this is something where there's bipartisan agreement that, look, if the state comes in and we're utilizing taxpayer dollars on this project, but the company goes back on what they said we're going to do, we need to make sure we have mechanisms in place to be able to get that money back. You look at something like Foxconn in Wisconsin, which I think sent, you know, nightmares down anybody who thinks about this kind of work, because that was a project that, again, Michigan was bidding very heavily on. People were displaced from their homes to make space for this manufacturing facility. And to date, they haven't produced anything. So mm-hmm. we've got to make sure as we're looking at building these tools that there are clawback provisions in place in case something does go sideways so that we are not on the hook for a private business not living up to what they said they were going to do.
And, you know, this is not a new discussion. This was front and center back in the 80s at the Poletown plant, the Hamtramck plant that GM built. And I mean, all of the eminent domain money that was spent and the lawsuits, and it was in the hundreds of millions of dollars, which back then was even a lot of money. You know, it's and but it came down, you were spending a phenomenal amount of money per job. Do we need a formula to somewhat cap and say, look, this is what we think these projects are worth, and being willing to say, you know, there are going to be some places that we won't go?
So I think what I think about more often is rather than thinking about a specific formula, because the reality is things change, that is there a way to look at the total amount of resources that we have available? We have a finite amount of money in our state budget. And looking at what we're investing in projects like this versus education or workforce development. And there are states like Tennessee who are now investing very aggressively to make sure that every resident has a post-secondary degree. They're behind us right now, but they're mm-hmm. catching up to us fairly quickly. So I think we have to be in the mindset of what is our total goal? Is our goal raising average household incomes? Is it making sure everybody has a degree? And if so, are we trying to incentivize our way out of a problem, or are we actually investing in the structural things we need to invest? So it might be we're reducing some of the total incentives and we're increasing the investments in education, recognizing it's not going to happen overnight. There are states who have taken a whiplash approach where they've ended incentive-based economic development only to come back swinging the other direction. And I don't think that's the right approach, but it's looking at what is the right balance for Michigan to make sure that all of our residents are going to be the workforce in the future that these companies actually really need.
You hosted an economist from the Upjohn Institute recently with some, I think, pretty creative ideas on how we can do this better. Were there some other key takeaways there for you that you want to explore in terms of maybe other benefits, not maybe the community benefits model, but other benefits that we can extract from these companies when they come here other than just jobs and payroll?
Yeah, something that Tim Bartik, who you mentioned, spoke about in committee is kind of coupling some of these incentive programs with customized workforce development programs. That is something that, you know, when a company is looking to invest, they want to know they have the qualified workforce. There's only so much that an incentive or a cash grant can do if you can't get the workforce that you actually need to do the jobs. So that's something that's really interesting is can we perhaps give a lower incentive amount, but create some of these workforce development programs mm-hmm. where the company is getting the workforce we need. And again, it's improving Michiganders' lives because they're upskilling themselves so that even if the company, let's say 10 years down the line, isn't around anymore, they've got the skills they need to go get another job.
Right. And that's a rising tide lifting all boats kind of scenario. But there are some other things where we've seen some conditions put on these companies when they come here, like no stock buybacks or discouraging those. Is there a slippery slope where our pursuit of benefits could backfire and be perceived as micromanagement of their business and lead them to go elsewhere?
you know, I think that's a good point. And the approach that I'm trying to take through our committee is recognizing that there probably isn't one thing that's right for every community. The CHIPS Act on the federal level right now, for example, requires that businesses who receive a certain amount of incentive provide childcare. That's fantastic. We have a childcare crisis right now, but that might not be the exact right thing that every community needs. Right. So what I'd like to see more is more local community engagement so that we understand for each of these projects, what does this community actually need? And can we build that in as a part of the guarantee for each of these projects in a way that makes sense instead of, you know, state level government oversight that might not be the right solution for everybody?
You know, we have seen these projects go to rural areas or rural-ish areas, and that's fine and good because we know some of these companies need a lot of land. However, do we need a even more focused strategy on better revitalizing industrial areas, brownfields, things like that, that have suffered job losses? Because it seems like a lot of our areas are getting left out of this.
I think we do. And something that Tim Bartik also mentioned is really trying to target some of these incentive programs on areas that have higher unemployment rates, because that's where this incentive is really going to pay off. If you're paying an incentive to a company that isn't in an area with high unemployment, really you're just taking somebody from one company who's already working into a new company and paying for that. So you're not actually creating a new job. If we target areas where there's already higher unemployment, where people have been displaced, where we've got some of these brownfield sites because some of these manufacturing centers have closed, we can actually get a higher return on what we're investing in as the state. So I think there's something to be said about these big projects that get all the headlines, but we have to diversify. Let's look at mid-sized businesses, small businesses, and really start to target some of these areas where we are either bringing people out of unemployment or actually attracting new residents to the state.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, we've heard an awful lot of grievances from Republicans about what they perceive as corporate welfare. I think there's some common ground here, and maybe we can get a more focused strategy that can benefit all of us. Senator McMorrow, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, Guy.
So it looks like they're voting on the right to work repeal right now in the legislature, and when that comes back. And then I think it has to go over to the Senate for just some minor revisions, and then it'll be a done deal, and it's off to the governor. And then begins probably the ballot petition initiative to try to restore right to work, which is really what, according to polls, most of Americans in the state of Michigan want. They don't want this repeal, and they're pretty aggravated at the Democrats for just trying to pay off their organized labor masters. And so we'll see what comes of that. We remember the big dispute over that Van Gogh at the DIA. We had a Brazilian supposed collector saying that he hadn't given permission for the painting to be displayed at the DIA in its most recent, it was a fabulous exhibition that they had. It's called The Novel Reader. And it ended up going to federal court because now DIA has this painting and they've been told, you got to hang on to it. You can't give it back because we don't know who the real owner is. And there was the claim that whoever lent it to the DIA, and it appears that the DIA was never charged with any wrongdoing. There was never any allegation of that. They had followed all the protocols necessary to confirm and verify provenance. Well, now a deal has been reached over control of the painting, and they've been told, DIA, that they can return it. The problem is we really don't have a resolution on what this was all about. We don't know yet who was right, who was wrong, whether there was permission or what. We just know that this group called Broker 8 Capital has said that it's going to get it back. And that they released what they have resolved it with what they call a confidential settlement. And so they're withdrawing the court filing. So we don't know if this guy really owned it or not. We don't know if the other person was engaged in some skullduggery by sending it DIA's way without the owner's permission. We don't know anything.
Do you think the DIA can still display it with it still in their possession despite the litigation, or are there restrictions against that?
Well, now that all of the, I mean, I suppose that the order to hold on to it is moot, they got to give it back. Here's the problem. Because of this lawsuit, the DIA had to spend about $100,000 to defend itself in court. Where do they go to get that money back? From these two knuckleheads that couldn't decide who really owned the painting?
Probably wiped out everything they made from the exhibit.
Yeah. So apparently there may be, they have some things that they need the Court of Appeals to rule on, but at least for now, they've been told that there is an agreement and that they don't need to hang on to it any longer, which I guess is somewhat of a relief. Kind of a sad day today, especially if you're a fan of the great American muscle car. Dodge rolled out what's been known as the last call models. They've been rolling out a lot of these SRTs, these massive muscle cars. And the final one dropped at the Las Vegas Motor Speedway. Literally, they didn't drop it. It descended from a helicopter. And it is a beauty. A 1,025 horsepower Challenger SRT Demon 170. And you can say that this era, at least, of Dodge muscle has come to an end. The gas-powered muscle is over. Probably going to be replaced by some kind of an EV, which will have some probably incredibly impressive acceleration. But I don't know how you duplicate the thrill of the sound of the spinning tires, of the whine of a 1,000-horsepower engine. And, of course, these things have really excited us at Roadkill Nights up on Woodward and elsewhere. And the folks at Stellantis have really done a great job celebrating the muscle car through all of this. But that is all coming to an end. I'm trying to see. It doesn't give me a 0 to 60 on it. But suffice it to say, it's enough that it will get your heart pumping and thumping. But as we look at that, it's time for Tuesday, and that's Mobility Makers, where we talk about EVs and autonomous driving. It's brought to you by Bridgestone. No matter what the next generation of mobility will be, it will be on wheels, and Bridgestone will be there. Bridgestone solutions for your journey. You remember back in January, we were at CES in Las Vegas, saw a lot of very innovative features on new automobiles, and Magna had one of the most curious. Donald Vandersloos is the one that introduced us to the new Mezzo Plus system.
Your car of the future may have surfaces that will actually morph. They will change for different functions. And they will do it without hinges and mechanicals. The actual surface of the vehicle will morph for you. It's called Mezzo Plus, and it's one of the new products at Magna. Daniel Vandersloos is here with me to tell us how these things will change.
Hi, Guy. Thanks for having us. So what we're looking at here is an opportunity to take a thermoplastic surface and with a no design compromise mindset, allow it to flex into the position to open and close for active aerodynamic features like an air curtain around a wheel or maybe actually opening up an aperture to cool a heat exchanger for a battery. Maybe at speed you want to really have a sleek, closed look and allow that surface to close, and typically have to do that with that complicated mechanism.
So in other applications that I've seen, let's say that you want the vehicle needs cooling, there's a louvers system, but that means hinges, it means different mechanicals. You aren't going to need that with your system.
No, that's the beauty of what we're calling morphing surfaces, is allowing for a no-compromise design, replacing those complicated mechanisms and segmented surfaces.
And you want it to be able to return to maintain those aerodynamics.
Absolutely. Based on the conditions of the vehicle, sometimes you need actually cooling at static scenarios, and sometimes you need it at speed. So it really depends on what that condition is, but they can be open or closed based on the vehicle state.
So one of the other things that you're doing at Magna is that when we get rid of the grill, that becomes a surface that you can use for badging, for branding, and I guess for messaging if you wanted to take it to the extreme.
Absolutely. And we start at the extreme and kind of work backwards, but we could actually have a new LED type matrix display communicating to the users, like maybe welcome or walk by or don't walk or halt.
But or you could put, if it's an Uber, you could put my name on.
Absolutely. If you're coming to the front of the vehicle, I could welcome you and actually say, Guy, this is your car. So in addition to that, we're looking at how to create brand distinction. So when we close that surface, it really becomes a new canvas. And with that surface being closed, it's not the traditional chrome and paint. Now it's content like radars and sensors and lighting to really differentiate one OEM from another.
Okay, so the other thing is messaging could get a little awkward. You know,
or maybe provocative.
Or provocative. We could be looking at another form of road rage here.
It could. I don't think we're going to necessarily let the users type in their phone, like, to a text to communicate, like, what the other person should be doing.
So if we were teenagers, we know what we'd be doing. We'd be putting our phone number up on the front of that. Hey, call me.
Could very well be the case, guys. That's a good one.
Yeah, misspent youth coming out there. But it's certainly from a branding opportunity for delivery vehicles, things like that.
Right.
It's got a lot of potential.
Brand distinction, you know, we just want to make sure that the OEMs and the designers, again, don't have a, just like morphing surfaces, don't have a compromise when they move from these grills, which are highly decorated, to a more panel structure. We still allow them to differentiate, like from a Honda to a BMW to a Ford. Want to allow that differentiation.
Does this add cost, or because you're taking a lot of the moving parts out, does it remove cost?
For the morphing surface, our target is cost neutral. And the benefit would be that there's less complexity. So hopefully, and ideally, there's also less weight.
Very cool. Magna Mesoplus morphing surfaces may be coming to a vehicle near you very soon.
Interesting stuff. And, of course, the 13-year-old that still lives inside my head was thinking about all kinds of things. But that's kind of a cool idea that you could, you could brand your business. There's a lot of cool things that could happen there, just some of the things that we saw. By the way, you Nick did find out, thanks to a quick listener, exactly how fast the Hellcat is.
Yeah, 1.66 0 to 60.
1.66 0 to 60 and does a quarter mile in 8 seconds. A lot of your lookbacks yesterday on the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq under President George W. Bush. A lot of recriminations about whether there were weapons of mass destruction there, whether we should have been there at all. Nevertheless, we were there, and we hoped to do good things. And we hoped that in the lens, as we look backward, we'll see that the blood and treasure that was spilled there did leave the Iraqi people in a better place 2 decades later. Martin Manna is the president of the Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce and the Chaldean Community Foundation, and speaks for a very important group, those Iraqi Christians who in the aftermath of the invasion still saw horrible persecution. And Martin, I just wanted to, first of all, it's been a while. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's great to connect again, Guy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, it was quite a mixed picture that I saw in a lot of the lookbacks yesterday. We saw some schoolgirls. We saw some of the freedoms that they have now. Not a lot about your community, though, and I want to get to that. But one of the things that we saw was the return of tourism to Iraq. Are Iraqi Americans, do they feel like they can return to the homeland and travel and visit those that are still there?
Well, 20 years later, I could tell you that that's actually a conversation that we hear about often now, people wanting to go back, visit their ancestral lands. There is a bustling tourist trade going on. And as you know, the Pope Francis was recently in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and I think that helped perpetuate need for more people to want to. There was just more curiosity for people to want to visit the country in general. But, you know, here we are again 20 years later, and if we learned anything, it's, the U.S. intelligence really failed in Iraq, and we should be holding our elected officials more accountable whenever they tell us that we need to go to war, that we're supporting wars, and Iraq is that example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they said that there was weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein was part of this, what took place in 9/11, and none of that was true. And more than 1 million Iraqis were killed and tens of thousands of others, including many U.S. military personnel who liberated that country, who many feel that didn't need to be liberated.
Well, and I guess you and others have schooled me at the time, and again, this is 20 years in the rearview, but that Saddam, for all of his atrocities, did kind of keep a lid on almost the tribal warfare that occurred there between different religions, Sunni against Shia, Shia against Christian. And with that void, it seems there was just a huge amount of persecution. Has that ended? Is this a more hospitable place for Christians now?
Well, I work on the issue daily with our congressional representatives, with the U.S. Embassy, and we have people that work for us in the northern part of Iraq and Nineveh. As you know, this was also historically really important to Christianity. It's the birthplace of Abraham. He came from Ur of the Chaldees. I was there with the U.S. congressional delegation at the end of November with the Congresswoman Slotkin. And the challenges remain. We've gone from 1.5 million Christians there to fewer than 200,000. Okay. Our areas are still disputed. They're being patrolled by Iranian militias. They're disputed between the Kurdish region and the central government. So there's a ongoing friction between the Kurds and the Arabs. If you were to ask the remaining 200,000 Christians there, you know, would they stay? More than 99% have said that they would leave if they had the opportunity. Mm-hmm. We still have several hundred thousand displaced throughout the Middle East, going to places like Australia and New Zealand because they're not given status to come here to the United States. I wish I could tell you things have gotten better, but, you know, we're going to always continue to fight to maintain our identity, our religion, our culture, our language in that region, because if not, it'll we won't exist. But things aren't looking good as they stand right now.
So in retrospect, as you look back, do you think the American invasion of Iraq made things better or made things worse for Christians?
Oh, much worse. You know, I could just tell you, I was happy to hear not too long ago, the one light at all of this is King Abdullah of Jordan talking about the need for all of the Middle Eastern leaders to come together to preserve Christianity throughout the region because it's under assault, and that a Middle East will not thrive without Christians there having a Christian presence there.
I remember, gosh, this goes back now almost 20 years, my former colleague Roger Weber doing a story with a young woman who was celebrating her first Christmas in America, having been in the Christmas Eve bombing of a church in Iraq. And I believe it was on the outskirts of Baghdad, and having lived through that. Are those still everyday threats, or is it more subdued than that?
It is more subdued. Like when I went there, I had the chance of visiting Mosul, and much of it has been rebuilt.
Wonderful.
But what's happened is there's just an ongoing intimidation, harassment by the supermajority there for minorities, specifically Christians. You know, recently Iraq passed an alcohol ban, and those alcohol-type businesses in Iraq, for example, employ tens of thousands of Christians. You know, if they eliminate this industry, they really have no other work. So, again, it's just ongoing, systematic discrimination, intimidation, harassment that the community has to endure, not only from, you know, Iraqis, you know, whether they're Shiite or Sunni or Kurds, but also because of the large influence of Iran now in that region. I mean, one big thing that has taken place as you look back at the invasion is Iraq is really being controlled by Iran. They're trying to create this superhighway connecting Iran all the way to Lebanon. And unfortunately, they're changing demographics, and it's not a good outcome for the Christians in that community right now or in that region.
You know, it was hoped, I think, by some that with the opening of Iraq that there was an opportunity to do business. Is that possible? I keep hearing that the level of corruption there is just crippling from a business standpoint.
It is. Even the financial system there is very difficult to do business. I mean, people have tried. I've been part of delegations. The U.S. Chamber has an annual mission to Iraq trying to promote business and economic development. Certainly, we're trying to do that even in the Nineveh Plain, where we have our ancestral villages and still a large Christian population. But there is a widespread corruption amongst the public officials, so doing business there has not been easy.
So are you going to be going back? Do you feel that, I mean, without going with a group or a contingent from the government, that you can go there as a private tourist and feel comfortable as an Iraqi Christian with returning to the homeland? And are there antiquities left that you can enjoy? We know that we saw just a pillaging of many of our most sacred sites.
You know what's been interesting, like you look at some of the departments here in the United States, like Department of Homeland Security and others, there was actually a Chaldean representative of one of the departments that return some of the antiquities to the Iraqi ambassador to the United States. I mean, talk about a unique story.
Yeah.
But we are focused on preserving our identity there. And as long as there's even one Christian in the country, we will continue to work for them and to support them. So we're doing annual missions now to the region. We are also supporting the locals there by buying goods and that they are making in our villages. And then our big focus now has been advocacy with our U.S. government, our congressional representatives, and with the Iraqi government. Can you imagine if they treated minorities in Iraq like they do here in the United States? We'd be living like kings. But we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Yeah. No question about it. And this idea of diversity, equity, inclusion that we're trying to, give a cradle to here in the United States, if something like that could be exported, where it's truly inclusive, not the kind of choicey inclusion that we're seeing sometimes in this country. Martin, it's always a pleasure to connect, and you do such a great job of being a wonderful voice for your community, and we just wanted to check in and 20 years later see if things have improved, and we'll hope for even more improvement and progress going forward.
Thank you. God bless. Keep up the great work.
We won't forget our Christian friends there. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Thank
Martin Manna, the president of the Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce and the Chaldean Community Foundation, here on Newstalk 760. It's a nagging question. You know, we send a lot of tax dollars to Washington, and the question becomes, do we ever see them come back? I'm not a big believer in these Wallet Hub studies, but this is pretty easy for them to track. And they looked at the gross amount of tax receipts coming out of the state of Michigan that go to Uncle Sam, and then they look at the amount of the government spending. They break it down by things like education, the health dollars that come back, safety and law enforcement, the economy, economic incentives, also infrastructure and pollution, which obviously is always a big issue here in the state of Michigan. So where do we rank? How are we doing? Well, we rank 21st in terms of taxes paid per capita. And what's our return on investment? Well, we're 28th. That makes us a donor state, which makes us sound a lot nicer and more generous than I think any of us would like to be. We'd kind of like to be even, wouldn't we? Maybe come out a little bit ahead, given the fact that with infrastructure, certainly we have challenges that a lot of southern states don't. We've got an aging population. Our health needs are probably a little bit higher. Certainly with the Great Lakes being a concern, pollution and conservation dollars are important. So how do we do on those metrics? Well, as we sit at number 28 behind, Pennsylvania, Illinois, most of our Great Lakes states, Ohio, we rank 28th for education. The one category where we do a little bit above average is in health. Apparently, we're getting more health dollars back. That's okay. Safety and law enforcement, our poor cops are getting strangled here. We're not getting the amount of money back that we should. When it comes to the economy, we're 26th. When it comes to infrastructure and pollution, we're number 27. Golly gosh, who do you think is number one on this list? What state comes in and gets the best return on investment for their tax dollar? Why, that would be the state of Virginia. Which, when you border the District of Columbia and you are home to most of the federal lawmakers that dole out the ducats and the bucks, yes, indeedy. The folks in Virginia, fourth in education, second in economy, eighth in safety. The only one where they're getting a little bit shafted is on eight. But they are number one, followed by Minnesota, Vermont, New Hampshire. Here's kind of a funky thing, though. Red states get a much better return on their investment. Those that are ruled by Republicans, they have a better rank than Democrats, even though they are no longer the party in power. Maybe that's because they did have control of the White House for a while there, but they don't define it, but they do break it down within partisan stuff. Going to be a heck of a showdown. The USA-Japan game that is setting up for the World Baseball Classic coming up tonight at 7 p.m. WJR Senior Sports Analyst Steve Courtney joining us live with that story. It's Mr. Ohtani in the lineup.
Oh, yeah.
He's healthy.
It's going to be riveting there, Guy. No doubt about it. For many reasons, which we'll get to in a second. Let me just say this. Our conversation brought to you by the Performance Remodeling Sweepstakes. Tourney time is here, you know. Performance Remodeling is in the game with their $100,000 Window of Opportunity sweepstakes. Log into windowsroofingsiding.com. Take your shot today for a chance to win Performance Remodeling's $100,000 Window of Opportunity sweepstakes. And indeed, Guy, in between March Madness and NFL free agency, the World Baseball Classic has been going on, and tonight it pays off in the championship game down there in beautiful Miami, Lone Depot Park to be more exact. You've got the United States, the defending champs, and you've got Japan looking to win its third WBC title after eliminating Mexico in a dramatic semifinal. As a matter of fact, let's stop there, set the plate. Munetaka Murakami, a Japanese Triple Crown winner who, at 23, already considered among the best hitters in the world. It was the eighth inning last night. Two runners occupied first and second base with nobody out, and Japan trailed Mexico by a run in the WBC. Murakami got what he was looking for, a 94-mile-per-hour down-the-middle fastball from Team Mexico closer Giovanni Gallegos, and sent the offering 0-400 feet to straightaway center field. Yeah, it was a walk-off win for Japan. Now on a collision course with the United States. And this is going to be dandy watching tonight. First pitch, by the way, at 7 o'clock. The United States offensively, Guy, absolutely loaded. You've got Trey Turner, Mookie Betts, Mike Trout in the numbers 9, 1, and 2 spots. How about Trey Turner? Already a hero for the United States in the WBC. He has homered, as a matter of fact, three times in his last two games. But the matchup, obviously, everybody is looking for. Mike Trout going against his Angels teammate, yeah, Shohei Ohtani. And it's going to happen, you would think, anyway. Probable starters, I'll let you know. Team USA is going to start Merrill Kelly. He belongs to the Arizona Diamondbacks. Japan, meanwhile, will send out Shota Imanaga. In case you're wondering what his background is, he plays for Yokohama Dene Bay Stars of the Nippon Professional Baseball League there in Japan. Interesting, they are going with Imanaga over Shohei Ohtani and the crafty seasoned veteran Yu Darvish. So sit back and let the games begin.
Yeah, that'll be a fun showdown and a nice matchup. Except sad news to report from the NBA, Willis Reed, who was such a dominating
just a beast
force. Oh, my Lord. He was LeBron before anybody knew what that was in terms of just brutalizing people in the paint, but dies at the age of 80.
Yeah, a very nice run for one of the NBA's all-time greats. And truth be told, his amazing career, perhaps a bit before my time. Obviously, you've seen a lot on film and whatnot. And didn't he play
really?
In a broken leg?
Really? You're gonna give me that?
Yes, I am.
Because I remember it vividly.
In the later parts of his career, what was I, like 12, 13, somewhere around there? Maybe younger? But I do remember the ferocious way he played the game. And, you know, you didn't want to be just hanging around him.
That
because,
was...
He was poetry in motion for a big fella.
That was like an M1 tank, shoulders like that as well. And I guess his elbows were pretty good too. Yeah, we're losing a lot of the greats that way. But
no doubt about it.
R.I.P. Willis Reed. Steve, thanks so much. That game's 7 o'clock tonight. Who's got it?
That's on FS1, my friend.
All right, we will we'll be watching for that showdown. Thanks so much.
You better believe.
Talk to you tomorrow, buddy.
Enjoy the day.
Let's see, it is now official. The Michigan Senate just took the final vote on the bill to repeal right to work. They now formally send that to Governor Gretchen Whitmer. What will befall the Michigan economy as a result of that? It won't make us better. That is for sure. Prevailing wage will not get more people hired. It will just make your public works projects more expensive. We'll sort through that and much more tomorrow when we see you at 3. Take care.